Okay. We're here in FPH on March 24th, 2003, for a public forum on the war with Iraq. It's presented by the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies. Expert speakers will be Elizabeth Hartman, John Western, and Michael Clare.
This evening. We're going to get started in just a second. Welcome everyone to Hampshire College. I'm Michael Clare, the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies. We're sponsoring this event this evening. Let me tell you our intentions and our plans for this evening. There's many activities going on in connection with war with Iraq in the Five College area. Many of you are probably involved in all kinds of activities. So our purpose here is to create a space for discussion and conversation and analysis. That's our primary effort, but to maximize the participation of all of you in this process. So I've asked four people, including myself, to speak for no more than 10 minutes. And we'll be very strict about that, so that, you know, after each person has had their 10 minutes, that will leave lots of time for discussion and questions and points to be raised. And that's really what I hope to accomplish, is to give you an opportunity to think about the issues, to raise questions. Many of you may be planning to participate in or to organize other kinds of events, and we will give you an opportunity to announce those. And some of those we'll announce ourselves. So there will be an opportunity for everyone who wants to provide another kind of forum than this. We'll give you that opportunity to do so. But our purpose tonight is really conversation. That's the main thing I want to say. There'll be teach-ins all day tomorrow at UMass, beginning at 10 a.m. in the morning and continuing all day. I'm afraid I don't have the precise information. Is there anyone from UMass here who can tell us where those events will be? I think they'll be in
the campus center.
What's that?
Over the campus.
Campus center. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. On Wednesday evening, at 7 p.m., there'll be a conversation about the war at Mount Holyoke College at 7 p.m. in Gamble Auditorium, sponsored primarily by the International Relations faculty at Mount Holyoke College. I know there are other events being planned. Those are the ones that I know of that are of a teaching or a conversational character. So I don't want to spend any more time than necessary in preliminaries. I want to get us into this discussion. I know you have lots on your mind. Let me tell you the program. Our first speaker will be Gregory Prince, the president of Hampshire College, who will set the stage for our discussion and make some comments from his own perspective. I will follow with no more than 10 minutes on the military situation, as I said. Then John Western, who's a professor of international relations at Mount Holyoke College and a Five College professor, will speak on international aspects of the conflict. And then Betsy Hartman, who's a professor in the School of Social Sciences here at Hampshire, will speak on domestic aspects and the anti-war movement. So that's the plan. And then we'll open it up to conversation. Without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Gregory Prince. I just want to say one thing for myself. I've been here 18 years, and it's horrible when a war starts. I just want to say personally, I'm very happy that this is where I am when a war starts. Thank you.
Michael, thank you, Betsy, John, for being here to help facilitate this conversation and to provide some material for it. I have two things I would like to do. First, speaking as the president of the college, to thank all of you for being here, to thank them for organizing this, and to remind the community that where there may be a large number and maybe an overwhelming number of individuals in the community who are opposed to what is happening in Iraq, it is not uniform in this community, nor in Amherst or in the surrounding area. There are members of the staff of Hampshire College who have sons and daughters who are in the military. There are some whose children are now, they're not children, they're young men and women, who are in more than harm's way. So that as you listen to each other and have this conversation, please, as we have, I think, done in the past, to a very high degree, in a way that I have been extraordinarily proud as president of this institution, remember that be sensitive to those diversity of opinions, diversity of experiences, and the fact that there are people who themselves may be opposed to the war but have family members who are at tremendous risk, either in the military or abroad, and try to be supportive of everyone even as we debate the politics of it. That is, I think, important for any intellectual community, and it is a standard that this college, I think, has followed, even while we are noting very clear, a small majority often take one position that tends to be close to the liberal position. I would like to speak now personally in terms of my own view, and to try to at least give a context that I hope will be part of the conversation. This is somewhat of an extension of what I said on March 5th. But I feel it as strongly or even more strongly today. I certainly am opposed to what is happening in Iraq. But I'm also concerned that in the opposition to the war on Iraq, we have not given enough attention to what I think is a much larger context. As I said on March 5th, I don't believe this issue is about Iraq. It is about something much more fundamental with respect to the direction of this country. The policies that are being pursued in Iraq are part and parcel of a much larger vision of where and how this country should go forward. It is a vision that I hope many will begin to organize and act politically and will work through, and it will have to be through the elections as well as through protests, to try to set a different vision and a different standard. This is a vision for this country that is integrated and is both domestic and foreign in its vision. It is a vision that I call, which some causes some confusion for people, but I think is very real. It is a vision that is isolationist in its view of cultures. Isolationist, in this sense I mean, that the sense is that the values that we need to follow, the values that should guide us are rooted here, and that there is little to be gained externally in the way of value. That our values, our vision of justice, our vision of democracy, our vision of the world is rooted here. It's a very narrow, I think, ethnocentric, if you wish, view of the world. It is internationally isolationist in a very particular way. And it might seem very strange to say that when you're looking at what is happening in Iraq. It is isolationist in the sense that it is based upon the premise that determine our foreign policy, we shall determine our interactions with the world, we shall determine where we intervene and how we intervene based solely on our national and self-interest. It is a very 19th century view. These are views that are external, but they're also internal. And they play in the same way within our country. This is a group that believes that big government is a major problem. Government thought of in terms of a social regulatory body, a body that regulates our society, that seeks the common good, if you wish, through communal action, is a problem. Through regulation, we limit our ability for independent, creative initiatives. Big government is a problem. And in the same way, the United Nations was a problem because it was big government on the international scale. It was an attempt to create a social framework internationally and globally that paralleled what the federal government was doing in this country and was just as much of a problem as our federal government. So big government, whether it be the UN or the federal government, was a problem. This is a view of the world that believes domestically We should remove the restraints on competitive enterprise to allow people to pursue their own vision of their self-interest, a vision that is extended externally when you look at the way we rejected the Kyoto agreements. This is not, and do not underestimate, the sense of coherence and vision that this administration is bringing to the problems that it addresses. It has a very clear, I think, coherent and integrated view of the world, domestically as well as internationally. And they are enacting that vision. Iraq is simply one piece of a whole. It was a piece that I saw first with Kyoto, which is not so much that we rejected it, but it was the way and the tone with which it was rejected. It is a piece with the way we've dealt with the United Nations. Yes, we went to the United Nations, but we didn't go to the United Nations at the beginning. We went to the United Nations 6 months into the Iraq crisis with a take it or leave it approach. It is the way we are treating the North Koreans. It is the way we treated China when they intercepted our plane. And for the first week, we refused to talk with them. Finally, we backed off. It is a sense of values and a sense of way the world should be administered and the way activities should be carried out. Iraq is only part, I think, in some respects, which seems very hard, a small part of a much larger vision of where this country should go. And it is one that I find personally very disturbing. So that as we talk about Iraq, and we talk about the issue, for example, of oil, certainly oil is an issue. Oil in terms of its impact, that is impact on this country, but it is not oil simply in a simplistic view of Mobil or Exxon wants more oil. Its oil is important to the global economy as we see the global economy, and therefore it must be available to the global economy so that we can have an economy on a global scale that we think is the right economy for the world. And that is a part of the much larger vision of what the world and the world economy should be. So oil, yes, is important, but it's not a simplistic view of oil. In the end, as we carry forward this debate, my final word is that we have to be very careful that we do not simplify the issues on our side in the same way that I fear they are being simplified on the other side. I fear that those who are making the policy decisions have deeply felt, very clear visions of the world that are far too simplified, that are profoundly misunderstanding the world they're dealing with, that are simplistic in the worst possible way. But if those who wish to argue and put forward a different vision are no better in their simplifications, we will have a major problem. The thing that is most missing in the current policy is a willingness to accept the complexity of the world, to appreciate the values and the complexities of values that are in conflict with each other, to respect that complexity, to understand that complexity. There's a desire to simplify and to therefore have a very clear path of action. In opposing that path of action, we cannot simplify ourselves. If we become so simplistic in opposition, we will in the end undo any chance of creating a vision of the world that is much stronger. That vision, to me, and there's not time to go into it tonight, but I hope there is time to talk about what should be replacing what we're doing. That vision, to me, has to be rooted in the United Nations. It has to be rooted in the multilateral view of the world that we have been trying to develop over 50 years imperfectly as it has moved forward, a view of the world which in effect has to give value to multi-values, multicultural values, to the world as a whole. There's an alternative vision that is a part of this society, but is a part of other societies, that we must give value to if we're going to create a counter force to what is taking place. One that is much more complicated and appreciates complexity more so than the vision that is now operating and is in ascendancy. And I hope that the conversation tonight will help develop the complexity of that view and that alternative vision of what we think we should be for, not just what we're opposed. Thank you for the time.
Thanks, Greg. I'm going to speak for 10 minutes about the military situation, and I'm going to do my best to offer some comments of assessment of what's going on, because I think it's important to try to do that. I'll be talking at that analytical level, but all of us, I'm sure, are aware that people are at risk at this moment. People are dying in Iraq on all sides, and human lives are at stake, and we mustn't lose track of that. And personally, I think that almost everybody who's going to be dying on all sides are really are victims of this situation. The Iraqis, the Americans are all victims of a situation which I think could and should have been avoided. But having said that, let me do my best to give you an assessment of where I see things. Now, before I go much further, let me begin by making a basic point. What we have here is a world-class, first-class military power, in fact, the world's most powerful military power in a very long time, backed up by a very potent second-class power, the British, fighting a third or fourth-class power, Iraq. Furthermore, the attackers have complete control of the air, they have superior intelligence, and they've been degrading the enemies, Iraq's military capabilities for 12 years. We don't hear much, we didn't hear much up until now about Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch. And going on for 12 years now of bombing Iraqi air defenses throughout that period, as well as periodic attacks on Iraqi capabilities. So you have a military force that 12 years ago in 1990 was a rather potent military force. The one that the United States encountered in Kuwait in 1991 was a fairly potent force. The armies that we're facing today are probably a third as large as the one that we fought, the coalition forces fought in 1991, but its equipment is much poorer than the army that we encountered back then in terms of the number of tanks, the number of aircraft, the heavy equipment, the supplies, the technology, all has been significantly degraded during this period. Probably two-thirds of their heavy equipment was destroyed in Operation Desert Storm. It has not been replaced. The embargo has been completely effective in terms of preventing the resupply of the Iraqi military with conventional military equipment. So this is a much weaker force than the United States and its allies confronted 12 years ago. So it's very hard for me to imagine that the gravely weakened third-rate power is going to prevail in this contest against the world's first-class power and a very powerful second-class power. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So the question is not, in analyzing the war, it's not the question of who will win. This is not a war in the Clausewitzian sense, where two armies clash on the battlefield, and until the smoke clears, and on the basis of superior generalship and all of that stuff, one side or the other prevails. This is not a war in that sense. This is more in the nature of a police action with a world superior power conducting operations against a much weaker opponent. That's what we're really, so the question is not who is going to win. We know who is going to win this war. It's not Iraq. Nonetheless, there are important questions raised here. How quickly and decisively will a dominant power crush the weaker power? And secondly, how will the victors be regarded by the survivors of this conflict by the defeated population? Will the victors be viewed as military conquerors who've overrun their country, or as liberators, as we have been told is their function? Those are the questions that remain. The answers to those questions are unknown. The question of who will win is known. Those two are not known. And these are crucial questions because the president has unveiled here a new military strategy, a very radical military strategy of preemption, of attacking enemy powers or supposed enemy powers before they've attacked the United States or its allies, or even are on the verge of conducting an attack. So you could say, well, they're about to attack us, we have intelligence, their planes are on the runway, they're about to take off, we're acting in self-defense. That's not even claimed. The claim is that maybe 5 or 10 years from now, Iraq will be a great threat to us if we didn't do anything, so we should attack them now at their weakest moment. So we're testing out here a very new and radical strategy, and so how the outcome of these other two questions about the how rapidly the regime collapses and how American forces are regarded will very much be part of the basis on which the American public and the world public will judge the legitimacy of this radical strategy. So where do we stand today? In a few minutes, a few points. First, bear in mind the war hasn't really begun yet. I say that because we all understood that there are two classes of forces in the Iraqi military. The regular army, which are draftees, young men scooped up, without much say in the matter, scooped up, given minimal training, bad equipment, bad leaders, not much support, stuck in the front lines. Nobody expected them to put up much of a fight. Rather, the war will begin when American forces encounter the Republican Guards and the Special Republican Guards, which are guarding Baghdad. And the expectation is that we won't really know about the course of the war until there's a direct confrontation between frontline American forces and these more professional, skilled Republican Guards. Those clashes may come very soon. The opening skirmishes, from what we can see, the Republican Guards have been fighting quite intensively. So we're really just now on the verge of the real war. What we've seen up until now is opening skirmishes, but not the real battle. So what can we say about these opening 4 or 5 days that we've seen? I think there are three things that we can say so far. And I keep repeating, the war hasn't really begun and things could change very quickly, so don't view these are preliminary observations. That's all they are. Please feel free to question me. Here's the three things that we could say. First, we have not seen the collapse of Iraq's ability to conduct war. The central government has not imploded, as some people suggested would happen very quickly, and that its ability to resist would erode very quickly. That hasn't happened. Clearly, the Iraqi government, who's ever in charge, I have no idea who's in charge, but the Iraqi regime still has not lost its ability to sustain serious warfare. Secondly, so far as we could tell, the destruction of all of these palaces and government buildings that have been so visible on television, the shock and awe strategy has destroyed a lot of buildings. I have to say that they cost a lot of money to put up those palaces, and I think it's a terrible shame that money that could have been spent on food and medicine was spent on palaces. They've been destroyed. That doesn't seem to have had the effect of stopping the government from functioning. Clearly, the government is functioning from somewhere else other than those palaces. So all of those explosions that we've seen, so far as we can tell, have not actually crippled the government. 2 minutes? Okay, thank you. And we haven't seen any defections or surrenders by mainline units. So some frontline units. These draftees have surrendered, not in immense numbers, but no Republican guards have surrendered. So all the talk about, you know, these early surrenders hasn't come to pass. That could change in 24 hours, but that hasn't happened yet. Secondly, at least some of the regular forces are actually putting up resistance. Now, this is significant because, you know, we were told to expect that the regular forces would surrender at the first sign of American troops. Some have, but others are fighting, and this is an important indication that support for the regime or for the nation, or we don't know what the people are fighting for, whether they're fighting for Saddam Hussein, as we're told, or they're fighting for their families or whatever, we don't know really. But the fact that regular soldiers are putting up some resistance is significant because it indicates that the regime isn't only propped up by the Republican Guards, who were expected to fight. So that suggests a degree of loyalty to the country or to something that's greater than expected. And this is a sign of a worry. And third and finally, I have to say personally, this doesn't look like liberation to me. Maybe it looks differently to other people. I don't see it. The idea was that the masses of Iraqi people would come running out when they saw the first American tanks and shower roses on them and plant kisses on the soldiers. As Dick Cheney said, they would be dancing in the street at the first sign of American forces. Look, I'm not saying this won't occur down the road. You're skeptical, but it hasn't happened. We have not seen dancing in the streets. What appears to be the case is that people are sullen. The reports from the Qusar and Nazaraya and other cities where reporters have gotten in, what they're encountering is sullen resentment of the Americans and the British. They're not jumping up and down and praising the invaders for freeing them from Saddam Hussein. And these are people who do not report loyalty to Saddam Hussein, but they express anger at the invasion of their country, the fact that civilians are perishing in these urban battles, that they have suffered for many years, they're hungry, they're angry about what's happened to their country. So we're not seeing the cheering that some of us may have, or some people may have been led to expect. It still does not look like liberation to me. Again, we shouldn't read too much into this, but it's from this stage, and I'm done. These signs should be signs of concern, because winning the war is the easy part. The U.S. military knows how to do that. They will win the war for the reasons I've given. Winning the peace is a much harder job. And winning the peace is what's going to matter over the long term, over history. And clearly the job is going to be a lot harder if instead of being viewed as liberators, American and British troops are viewed as unwelcome conquerors. And that's the way it looks now. So those are my remarks. You'll have a chance to throw questions at me. I want to go immediately to get in some kind of international perspective.
Thanks, Michael. Okay, so I have the international aspects of what's happening. Where does one start? First of all, the United States is the most powerful country the world has ever seen, militarily. It is unrivaled. There is no other power in the world. But alas, what we have here is a situation where there's an awful lot of political objectives that have to be met, and it's not clear that the United States is unrivaled in terms of its political power. And ultimately, winning the peace is going to require a lot of political maneuvering, and we haven't seen that thus far from this administration. What I want to talk about a little bit is, I think all of you know descriptively that the United States stands largely isolated in this military action. Yes, we have Great Britain and Australia, and there's, I guess, recently a few Polish units that are now on the ground in Iraq. But other than that, it is an extraordinarily isolated American position. So I'd like to address my comments tonight to why that's the case. What's going on? Why is the U.S. So isolated in this situation? And then second, talk a little bit about the longer term implications and what can be done. I think to get a handle on the kind of descriptively and analytically why the U.S. is so isolated, I think we need to look at a couple of different dimensions. First of all, look at the short term and the long term. If I had five more minutes, I'd do the medium term, but I don't. So the short term and the long term kind of situation. And then I think it's also important to distinguish the international reaction to the American effort by looking at the response from the allies, from other friends in the international system, from kind of the fence sitters in the international system, and finally those who are the traditional American adversaries. First of all, in the short term, what we've seen in terms of the reaction to the military action, I think, is overwhelming opposition, a striking overwhelming opposition globally. There is a 40-member international coalition participating in Operation Iraqi Freedom, but as I mentioned, there's only a few countries that have troops on the ground. Of that coalition, those 40 members in that coalition, there are only three countries that have a majority of their domestic population supporting the war effort. That's the United States. Great Britain, in recent polls just released today, have now crossed over the 50% threshold, and Israel. All of the other countries in the world, no other country in the world has a majority of their population that support the American action in Iraq. So it's not really a real coalition that we're talking about. It's they call it the coalition of the billing, but the White House actually changed that on their website over the last couple of days. It's no longer the coalition of the willing. I think they were getting too much ridicule from those who were calling it the coalition of the billing. But the point is they dropped it. It's now the coalition forces, not the coalition forces. The other country we just don't know what the domestic political reaction is Iraq. We don't know. And I kind of agree with Michael on this kind of note that it doesn't look like liberation yet, but we don't know. And it may not be rose season, so that's why we don't see the roses. But it also, it's a situation where civilians tend to be a little shell-shocked. And until they fully understand what the likely outcome of the war will be, there's often a delayed response. I look at the situation in Serbia, for example, where many people oppose the American bombardment of Kosovo and of Serbia. After the fact, there was a little bit more of a kind of, okay, this was helpful in helping us get rid of Saddam, or getting rid of Slobodan Milosevic. But anyway, I agree, we don't know what's going to happen in terms of the public reaction in Iraq. It's the great unknown. But what else we have seen in the short term in terms of the international reaction is we've seen globally international increase in terrorist threat warnings. There's a general feeling out there that the American action is provoking international terrorists to some degree. We've seen some embassy closings, and the United States has closed some embassies. It's downsized the number of embassies in response to this anticipated increased threat. We've seen a lot of diplomatic demarches issued against the United States and a lot of diplomatic and political statements condemning the American action. We've also seen a lot of domestic protests that we'll also hear about. But I think and we've also seen an awful lot of international protest actions, which I think are striking. They are profound. We are seeing an American position that I think is more isolated than at any time than since probably the bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War era. The demonstrations that we're seeing are, I think, significant along a number of dimensions. And let me break them down just briefly along a couple of different dimensions. First of all, let me talk about the allied reaction, the demonstrations that we're seeing in American allied capitals, the capitals of American allies, in Europe in particular. We're seeing significant demonstrations, protest actions throughout the streets of Paris, Madrid, Berlin, in significant numbers. But even this doesn't completely tell the whole story of American isolation, I think, or America's isolation in this situation. There have been protest actions against American policy in the past. In 1990-91, for example, during the Persian Gulf War, there were protest actions in Europe. During the early 1980s, when the United States deployed the Pershing 2 and the cruise missiles to Europe, there were all kinds of street demonstrations where there were those who were opposed to American nuclear policy. But what is different, decidedly different about this situation, is that in those instances, there was still a residual public support for American policy. In the 1980s, for example, there was 45% of the European population that actually supported the deployment of the Pershing 2 and the cruise missiles. A significant portion of the population. Here we're talking about public opinion running 80-85% against the United States. And that's I think, really significant. And it has political implications internally for each of these countries, and also the relationship with the United States. Le Monde, for example, the French newspaper, after September 11th, this was the headline in Le Monde, was that we are all Americans. It was this great convergence of goodwill towards the United States. Last Friday, the headlines in Le Monde was, the American war has begun. So it's a very clear distinction between the post-September 11th and the current situation. In part, this reaction to the United States, I think, is that there's a substantive reaction. It's based on a substantive disagreement with American policy. There's clearly increased anxiety with America as American projection of power that is increasingly perceived as unchecked. Most people in Europe believe that the United States military action is illegal, that it is illegal and illegitimate, not only because it doesn't have Security Council authorization, but most of the prevailing commentary in Europe is that this is not a preemptive war per se, it's a preventive war. And a preventive war is different from a preemptive war. A preemptive war is that if you see forces massing on your border, you do have a certain legitimate ability to defend yourself by attacking preemptively before your adversary can attack you when their forces are massed on your border. The imminence of that threat is there. Here, this is a preventive war in the sense that we are striking Iraq so that they can't hurt us at some point in the future. They don't have their forces massed on the border, poised to attack the United States. It's a preventive strike. In that sense, substantively, this is a decidedly different type of military engagement. It's not preemptive, it is preventive. Many believe the United States is motivated by oil. Okay? It's a simplistic argument, but the prevailing view out there is that the U.S. wants the oil in the Middle East. And when President Bush stands up, as he did yesterday, getting off the helicopter coming back from Camp David, and was asked to assess the positive developments of yesterday's situation, what did he say? He said, well, we secured the oil fields in southern Iraq. Okay, if this isn't about oil, which it may or may not be, I'm not going to suggest that it is that simplistic. In fact, I think it's much more complex. But it certainly does not help the political dimension here to dispel the idea that this is about oil. And then there's also a lot of commentary in Europe and around the world about President Bush's kind of Christian evangelical fundamentalism. People are kind of the moralism that is embedded in the rhetoric. And one gets the sense that people are actually more concerned that might be the motivating cause because they sense that there is a crusading element to this as opposed to a material interest element, which is a little bit more identifiable. So all of those things come into this, I think, this reaction to American policy. There's also a stylistic thing that's going on here that is fundamentally antagonizing the situation. In 1990, when Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait, for example, President Bush Sr., 41, right, is that what we're calling 41? President Bush Sr. announced an American policy. He said, this will not stand. It was a unilateral declaration, said, we're not going to tolerate it, we're not going to accept it. But instead of kind of asserting that and then assuming that the outcome of American military action was self-evident, he deployed his diplomatic team on a massive effort to mobilize an international coalition. Secretary of State James Baker got on an airplane. Actually, he was sheep hunting in Mongolia with Soviet Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze at the time. And they got on a plane and they started traveling around. Baker went all around the world. He went to Europe 6 times. He went to Russia 6 times. He went to the Middle East 4 times. He went to Latin America 2x to mobilize this coalition. Face-to-face diplomacy was imperative for the purposes of mobilizing an international coalition. Mobilizing that international coalition wasn't to determine the outcome of a military action between the United States and Iraq to liberate Kuwait. From the Bush administration's position in 1990, that outcome was self-evident. The United States was going to prevail. But there were inherent risks and costs associated with military action that needed to be controlled. And the best way to mitigate those costs and to manage those costs was to enlist a broad-scale coalition. So when you've got Egyptian armored brigades crossing the desert, the Saudi desert, into Kuwait with you, it helps dispel some of the anxiety on the quote-unquote Arab street that this is American imperialism. It helps manage some of those costs. This administration has done nothing to dispel those kind of anxieties. In fact, it asserted its position and then basically said, you can follow us or you don't have to. And that antagonized the situation, I think, significantly. And then we've got the U.S. policy being tied to a whole host of other things that President Prince talked about in the Kyoto Protocol, the ABM Treaty, all of those other things. So for most of the rest of the world, this whole image of American foreign policy is being viewed through this lens of a much more aggressive, assertive demonstration of American policy, of American power. And that is clearly antagonizing the situation. In terms of how this is also being viewed by others, traditional allies or traditional adversaries, it clearly is an extraordinarily provocative situation. The Middle East clearly does not accept American action as anything other than imperialism, and a kind of a resurrection of imperialism, and a policy designed simply to get access to oil. Let me talk about some of the longer term dimensions of this. Basically, we don't know what's going to happen. But I think there are some things we need to look for to determine what we can expect. First of all, here are the benchmarks that I'm going to be looking for. First of all, what's the outcome of the war in terms of the speed with which it ends? Is there minimal street fighting in Baghdad, or is it going to be significant? What's the death toll? How much physical destruction? Is there a significant humanitarian crisis? Are there going to be discoveries of caches of weapons of mass destruction? What is ultimately the civilian response to the quote-unquote liberators? Are we going to capture and kill Saddam Hussein, bring him to trial? To what extent are there going to be discoveries of records linking the Iraqi regime and the Ba'ath Party to terrorist organizations, al-Qaeda or others? And also, finally, what is the post-war reconstruction process? What's the internal security dimension that's going to transpire after the war ends? What type of humanitarian distributions are going to be put in place? What type of civilian authority and legitimacy will those have? And ultimately, what is the kind of process by which civilians begin the process of routinizing their life and getting back to the day-to-day routine of getting up in the morning, going to work, etc.? Those are things that are unknown. We don't know what's going to happen. If all of those things fall into line, the longer-term implications are that the U.S. might be able to manage some of the down, kind of the negative consequences of its actions. If they don't, if those things all don't fall into line, if there aren't weapons of mass destruction caches that are found, if the civilian population does not accept Americans as liberators, this can have profound implications for global economic and political, the global political and economic situation and domestic fragmentation. My time is up, and I'll come back to this in question and answer. But my kind of final point is that we are, I think, in a very, very dangerous situation here, because the U.S. is taking an extraordinary gamble in this endeavor, and a lot of things have to come into place precisely right in order for things not to go bad and hurt. Thanks.
Hi, thanks very much. Thanks to Pod for holding this event, and like Michael, I'm really pleased at this moment in world history to be working at Hampshire College and living in this community. Well, my talk tonight is called Political Multitasking. Excuse me for that phrase, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought I should call it that. And tonight I'm not speaking as an expert, but as a participant in the anti-war movement, and I'm feeling my way day to day like everyone else in this room, caught kind of in between anger and fear, but also, whoops, and darkness. All but trying to find within that space the time for reflection. Well, this talk is based on reflections I have had not only during the last few days, but the last several years about how to build a broad-based, progressive social justice movement in this country, a movement which sees the connections between national and international policies, and which, while respecting difference, moves beyond the narrow confines of identity politics and single-issue politics. I hate to use this word, but this politics demands a sort of multitasking, or at least the ability to seek solidarity and information from activists and analysts in diverse social movements, and to incorporate that into one's own work. Tonight I'd like to speak on what such political multitasking requires in the current moment. First and foremost, of course, it demands that we keep up our resistance to war. Even if we have failed to stop the war, our collective pressure may be able to prevent some of the worst military excesses, and this can translate directly into saving the lives of Iraqi civilians and also American troops. To keep up our resistance, we need to remain optimistic, which is very hard these days. But I think we shouldn't be too depressed about the opinion polls, which tell us over two-thirds of Americans are for the war. Those figures change dramatically according to how the questions are asked. 200,000 people were on the streets of New York this weekend, and thousands more in other cities in the United States and around the world. I think we have to remember that and get solace for that. Secondly, we need to face up to the class challenges of this war and guard against the arrogance of white middle-class entitlement in framing both resistance and a proactive program of peace and social justice. This was brought home to me this weekend when I went to the demonstration at the Westover Air Force Base. There were families in front of their houses shouting insults at us and cars going up and down the road with American flags and giving us the finger. And in a way, it felt like Amherst versus Chicopee, you know? It felt like middle class versus working class to me in many ways. And in a depressed economy with enormous gaps between rich and poor, joining the military is often an economic, not a political or moral decision. There are students at the five colleges who are in the reserves because it is one of the only ways to pay for college. How do we negotiate this class divide? We can shout, support our troops, bring them home, but bring them home to what? And this brings me around to the third point. If ever there was a time to integrate issues of economic justice, it is now. Yeah. It is not only costing us hundreds of billions of dollars to destroy Iraq, but to pay Halliburton and other corrupt crony corporations to rebuild it. In the process, the government manufactures a false sense of scarcity as communities all over the country are forced to make massive cuts in education, healthcare, and job creation. The peace movement not only needs to make these processes transparent, but to put forward an alternative economic agenda that lasts beyond the immediacy of war. It is not only a peace dividend we are struggling for, but a profound transformation of business as usual. Fourthly, we need to draw the link between war at home and war abroad. For the survival of the national security state depends on both a highly racialized internal and external enemy. For over a decade now, the so-called war on drugs has been a war on communities of color in this country. Repression of immigrants was intensifying well before September 11th. Unless the peace movement seriously challenges the attack on the human rights and civil liberties of all those deemed other, forced outside the boundaries of privileged white American citizenship, it will fail to build an enduring alternative because the militarization of domestic society is precisely what has paved the way for militarism abroad. Fifth, we must also understand the link between war abroad and Bush's war on women and reproductive rights at home and around the world. It is a characteristic of fundamentalist regimes, and I believe we are moving ever closer to one in this country, that women's sexuality and reproduction become the target of state control, not only legally and administratively, but symbolically. And at times of war, gender differences become further reified and enforced, and male aggression and violence celebrated. And I would urge you all to come to the Reproductive Rights Conference we're having April 4th to 6th at Hampshire College, where we're going to be integrating discussions of reproductive rights, women's issues, social justice issues, and peace issues. Six, we must monitor and expose the environmental consequences of war. Even in times of relative peace, the U.S. military is probably the biggest single polluter and energy user on the planet. And in times of war, the damage is far more extensive. Moreover, as in the case of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, Bush will try to use the war as an excuse for further environmental deregulation. Seven, while our eyes are trained to the situation in Iraq, we must keep vigilant and look elsewhere for repercussions. About a month ago, a letter circulated from prominent Israeli academics warning of the possibility that Sharon would use the opportunity of war in Iraq to embark on a massive ethnic cleansing in Palestine. We must also consider what payoffs members of the Coalition of the Willing, or rather Coalition of the Killing, I would call it, not the Willing at this moment, have received for their support of the United States. We can be sure the U.S. will turn a blind eye to human rights abuses in those countries after the war and during the war. Eight, if and when the war comes to an end, we need to be prepared politically for the next stage, the occupation of Iraq. While the U.S. is already putting into place its own proxy rulers, the peace movement here needs to forge links and make common cause with progressive Iraqi groups, and I think this is something that people really haven't been thinking much about. We have to be ready to engage in an informed way in the murky politics of humanitarian assistance. Last but not least, we need to build a new positive vision of peace and security that eschews both American isolationism and imperialism and strengthens the rule of international law. What would real security look like? The dismantling of weapons of mass destruction in all countries, including ours. Institutions to end the impunity of war criminals, such as the International Criminal Court. Economic, social, and environmental justice that reduces the risk of conflict. A world that doesn't need borders, and a country that doesn't need so many prisons. Such positive visions are perhaps the hardest thing to contemplate in this bleak moment when one easily sinks into despair. But I have always found that looking forward is what keeps me going, imagining a better world. We can't allow the pictures of tanks and bombs and death and destruction on TV to block our own political imaginations. We have to stay firmly rooted in possibility in the grim days ahead. Thank you.
Don and Greg. Well, we did our part. We kept things really tight so that we could give you the opportunity now to raise issues with any of us. We were tight, we'll ask you to be tight too, so that there'll be a maximum opportunity. Anybody who wants to raise something will hopefully have an opportunity. I saw you're first and you're second. Please. Well, you only get one.
Okay.
That's one of the rules.
Back over spring break, I was at home watching the mainstream media. And what I saw, they showed pictures of when intrusive entered Kassar, is that how you pronounce it?
Kassar, I think.
Kassar.
Yep.
And it showed, one of the things they showed over and over again was a Marine pulling down a picture of Saddam Hussein, and then other Iraqis, people who lived in Kassar, pulling it down and show pictures of particularly one man who was walking up and down and dancing, essentially. So I was wondering, given that, how that corresponds with your appraisal, or if that's our bridge is being shown on the mainstream media, piece of it, or if there's other things that are concerned that aren't being
Yeah, actually, I think the site you're describing was a border city, right across the border, and I don't know much about that town. Umkasara was claimed to be under American control. Tonight, they say it's still not. So there's still fighting going on in the city. So it wasn't Umkasara, it was the border town. I know what you're describing, and there were a handful of people who did seem to welcome Americans. I'm basing my comments on tonight's news, the reporters in the city of Nasiriyah, where the heaviest fighting has occurred, and some reporters went in an area that had been cleared, and they described that people, civilians, came up and spat on the Americans or otherwise taunted the Americans in anger and complaining, you know, you destroyed our city. Why did you have to destroy our city? It wasn't pro-Saddam Hussein. I'm not saying he's pro-Saddam Hussein, but that's what I was basing that comment on. I recognize you next. And you're third and you're fourth.
I was going to come back to you. I also got an email where somebody was saying, you know, from a friend of mine in France saying, hey, Americans, like, look out for people who are coming from different countries who might be, I'm not sure what the word, some people are getting deported or being detained for questioning here in the States. And I'm wondering how much of that is true and how much of that is happening and what we can do, because it seems like that's a really important part of the domestic activity.
Yeah, I think this is your question.
Well, I can't say exactly what's happening on the Canadian border, but there are groups like the National Network of Immigrant and Refugee Rights who probably maintain on their website current information on what's happening. I certainly know, just, you know, we've had a speaker back out, international speaker from our conference, because she was afraid she might be detained in immigration because she's from Bangladesh. And I think people are feeling very nervous about that. And certainly the intensification, you know, they're interviewing Iraqi immigrants to the United States now, and there's really a kind of racial profiling going on that's been going on since September 11th, but will definitely intensify in this period. We need to be very vigilant about it, and you know, keep getting information and keep protesting too, because also if they put in even harsher measures than the Patriots Act, which is pretty harsh already, we can see more violations of civil liberties.
Recognize, yes.
Yeah, it seems like the Bush administration message is essentially that if an adversary country shows that it's nuclear weapons and that it's willing to use them, that's the only way that that country will receive negotiations with the United States government. And I've been really concerned about North Korea, and do you think that that message is correct? So my analysis of that message is correct? And do you think that the U.S. policy in North Korea is similar to Iraq being regime change?
Why don't you start, John?
I think there are two issues that are raised by that. One is that there's a recognition within the Bush administration, at least now, that politically and militarily, North Korea is a much, much more difficult thing to deal with. It has not just nuclear capabilities, but it's got a much bigger army that is massed in proximity to South Korea. So militarily, any type of military conflict between the United States and North Korea could fundamentally devastate South Korea and have profound and global political and economic ramifications as a result. So it's a different situation. I think Iraq posed, for this administration, Iraq posed a bit of an easier target, so to speak. But the other lesson here, and I think this is one of the longer-term implications of American policy, which is there are powerful incentives built into this conduct for the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction by those states that we hope don't proliferate. What they're looking around and seeing is, well, what's different between Iraq and North Korea is if North Korea has nuclear weapons, Iraq does not. So if you're going to challenge the United States. You can't do it mass on mass. And if you don't want to live subservient to American power in perpetuity, you better take the gamble and go get nuclear weapons. And there are powerful incentives for proliferating at this point, it seems to me. And if the United States gets bogged down in any way in Iraq, and this gets long, you know, protracted, there are even more powerful incentives for states like Iran to take up its nuclear program, for North Korea to restart its nuclear reactor immediately while the United States is bogged down in Iraq.
Yes.
I thought it was interesting when you mentioned that the last moment in U.S. history where an administration has isolation the current administration was the invasion of Cambodia in 1970. And in response to that, the anti-war movement spontaneously erupted in a massive, unprecedented collective action. U.S. history was the strike wave that swept the country in May for a recent shutdown over 700.
And supposedly one of our main goals is to liberate the Iraqi people. Why use such violent force and terrorize their nation, as these Iraqis were saying, you know, why did you destroy our city when it would be cheaper for us to just take over the country? We'd save $10 billion if its GNP is only $90 billion and we're spending $100 billion. Why are we using such violent force and not just using a more imperialistic and forceful measure?
What would that be? I'm not sure.
Well, why haven't we learned a lesson from Project Desert Storm, in which we created a very provocative situation in the Middle East, and then trying to use some more peaceful approach to this and save money as well as secure our oil fields?
You're asking why, if Amanda said it correctly, you're asking why is the U.S. engaging in such a costly and violent solution? Yeah. I'll let anybody else who wants to comment, but I'll start this one by saying that I really think that Iraq is not the target of this war. That Iraq could be dispensed with, could have been contained without going to war. It could have been.
Which is what I'm asking. Why
yeah.
are we?
Because I think this administration is governed by a set of strategic principles laid out in something called the National Security Strategy of the United States of America, which you can get from the White House website. Which calls for the U.S. to be the dominant military power indefinitely, and also to intimidate other powers from ever challenging the United States. And this is the key language. It originally appeared in the Defense Guidance document that was released in 1992, which was written by Paul Wolfowitz, then a deputy Secretary of Defense, now the Undersecretary of Defense, and it finds its way into the strategy document of September 2002, and I think the message of this war of shock and awe is to tell other challengers that are in fact more threatening to the United States, like Iran and North Korea, and ultimately China. I think this is a message aimed at Beijing, Pyongyang, and Tehran, because the threat from this third-rate power does not require this level of violence. I'm agreeing with you. I think it's a demonstration, and it's in line with the strategy of intimidating other powers from ever challenging the United States. Now, if any of my co-panelists wants to speak otherwise, I think so.
Now, I'm talking about the unintended consequences of nuclear proliferation. It's almost inevitable. If you look at what Weichert said, the intention is to intimidate. The lesson learned will be, if you don't have nuclear weapons, you have no way of avoiding that intimidation. I think North Korea is intensely concerned about its security and feels intensely threatened and will do all it can, I think, to expand the number of atomic weapons it has and its disposal to make the cost of exercising that power on that country too great for us to be willing to do it. And it is the Wolfowitz doctrine of that intimidation, but I also believe that it could be more fundamental. It is a belief that power ultimately is the only value that matters. And that's even to be more frightening. It isn't just that we're going to intimidate, but it is the belief that that is the value that matters. And don't shoot the messenger. I think Katie and this group genuinely believe that is the only thing that the rest of the world will respect. And that therefore, when they finish this, they may not give us roses, they will respect us. My argument earlier, and I think Betsy put it more clearly in her point, that this is an integrated set of values and views of the world that come together in a way that is so denying of other values, of other views, religious, philosophical, whether it be Tibetan Buddhism or any other set of values, that there is some other way to look at the world other than the way they look at it. Because they are absolutely convinced that this is the only set of values that doesn't. So use the power. It's a way of teaching a quote more or less.
And that's you're next. And then you'll be, and then you. And then I'll get others. And if I point it to you and I forget, remind me.
I was wondering about the invasion and the push for attacks on Arizona, and we would put it, especially the relationship with the project.
Try to some research on that, so maybe John, you want to speak to that.
The project for a new American century, I think, is a template, but the reality is that there isn't. To some extent, there's a coherent doctrine out there. I think the doctrine is the U.S. National Security Strategy that was released last fall. And it is a doctrine that is, if you read that doctrine, there's something that's striking about it. Everybody focused on the preemptive side. It was policy of preemption, and everybody said, oh my gosh, that's a fundamental shift in American policy. But it really isn't about just preemption. It's about the projection of American power and a universalism and kind of an absolutism of American values. And it is, we've talked about it here. And it emanates from a multiple sources. Kind of historically, the American conservative movement and the neoconservative movement kind of generated this back after World War II, but in the 1970s with the Committee on the Present Danger, which was formed largely in response by former Democrats and conservatives in response to the emergence of the new left within the American Democratic Party and the emergence of the McGovernites. And the point there is that they wanted to reconstitute an American projection of power after Vietnam, when they sensed that the United States public was really weary of war. How do you do that? Well, you elevate the threat level. You talk about reconstituting American primacy in the international system. Ronald Reagan came into power, and many of those individuals who were part of this neoconservative movement found a home in the Reagan administration. And that was the reconstitution of American military power, the dramatic increase in defense spending, and the projection of American power through Star Wars and bearing the Soviet Union under the weight of massive defense expenditures. During the Carter administration, many of them left government and went into private sector, these quasi-public-private institutions, most notably the American Enterprise Institute, but also Cato and the Heritage Foundation, and they split around. And they reconstituted now with a critical mass in this Bush administration. And all of this predates September 11th, by the way. I mean, if you look at the ABM treaty, if you look at Kyoto, if you look at the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, you see this position of American primacy being fundamentally projected well before September 11th. But they also have a huge cadre of supporters in the neoconservative movement who remain in the quasi-public-private sector over AEI and the standard organizations, the Weekly Standard, the National Review, etc., which are the publications of the group. This can be a conservative movement.
Yes. You all kind of talked about how this is obviously about more than just the one. This is about what's going on here. With respect to people who, like you said, the people, the children that are there, do we have respect for and having, keeping in mind, what level would you say of radicalism and militancy against the kind of situation that's affected, without scaring people or taking people that have grown into this movement with a certain level of understanding of the situation? But also effectively combating as well.
That's a very good question, and I think there's no easy answer. I certainly think massive peaceful protests have been very important in terms of projecting a public image too. I think there also needs to be ways of reaching out. And there, on one side, maybe you have increasing militancy and civil disobedience among certain sectors. But I think, again, nonviolence, I think nonviolence better anyway, but I think it'll also sell better to undecided people. But I also think there needs to be some way to really start reaching out on a more grassroots levels through, community organizations, through labor unions, through, house-to-house kind of pamphleting, talking to people, going to shopping malls. I mean, just really trying to branch out beyond the kind of safety of communities that think more along one's own lines. But I think that's going to be one of the key questions ahead in the next few months.
Look, I'm 63 years old, so there's a generation gap in one sense, but I will always come back to the fact that if your generation, I'll use that phrase now, could take a lot of what Bessie put into hers in a very concrete way and come out with a declaration so that whatever the movement, whatever the protests are for something, maybe illusion, I don't want to get into a long analysis of the issue, but the forces that tend to win in the majority of the democratic process are those who have that are for something, that sort of advocating something that improves people's lives, not just stop something. And that there is a set of interconnected values here that need to be put together in a declaration. It may not be the Port Huron statement, but it's the equivalent of a statement which says, in effect, the Port Huron statement was what the Students for Democratic Society enacted back in
1963,
I guess it's the date. But the issue is creating that manifesto of things that one is for, the values of reduction in terms of the class disparities or the economic inequalities that are taking place in society, the rights of reproductive rights and women's health. Those issues are related to this. But there are huge class issues, huge social issues that are domestic as well as international. So that, to me, that is what is, it's always hard to do that because the moment you're always energized by the problem that you're trying to stop. But therefore, there is a need to try to create that declaration of values of that alternative that around which you build a coalition that can win the next election. And that is going to be as important as trying to slow the war down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a company who did it, felt there was a coherent doctrine, and it might be able to find it on the White House website. because I,
I was sort of afraid that we were actually encouraging proliferation via energy sanctions of North Korea. And maybe this is pointing to this whole Christian evangelical, you know, maybe something more like that.
Seems like Armageddon.
Yeah, like Armageddon.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, people say Bush is very evangelical himself, but certainly there's this whole Armageddon culture that's becoming quite popular in this country. We've read about those books that people are reading, and some of the language that he himself is using, whether he's using it to manipulate people or whether he believes that himself has a certain apocalyptic, you know, ring to it. But, you know, it does scare me. I think these people, I mean, I think there are material interests here, there are political interests here in terms of protecting American power, securing oil, and many of the other things that are said here, but I do think there also is a messianic quality to this that I find profoundly frightening. And I know that I have political friends in Britain who also feel the same way about Tony Blair, that he has a touch of that too, in a different way. But I think there is a true believer component here.
I do think, as Greg and others were suggesting, there is a belief, a profound belief in the utility of violence, and that's what that is the essence of this neoconservative logic. I don't think it's necessarily to invite Armageddon. I think the belief is that if you wave a big stick and crash it periodically, they're very explicit about that. You have to use the big stick periodically or it doesn't carry any weight. And people won't believe it if you just threaten it. You have to use it periodically. But if you use it periodically, then you'll get your way because other people will be intimidated. So there is this mystical belief in the value of violence that I think is terribly frightening. Because if they think it, and that's, the, I find profoundly divided about what happens in Iraq. If the victory is quick and, you know, and the whole place collapses quickly, I do think that will encourage the use of this strategy elsewhere. And it will never be this easy again. I don't think it will ever be this easy again. So that's very scary. Now, I do recognize one or two other people. Did you have your hand up before? Yeah. And then I saw Leonel. So it's one, two, and then you, and then back there, and then there. And I know I'm missing some people, but I'll do my best to get everybody.
All right, this is probably mainly for Professors Blair and Western. If we sort of assume that the message we get is equally somebody's pocket and has an agenda. Let's go beyond, say, take me to cover yourself this war with a grain of salt. What grain of salt do you take with you? How do you look at the barrage that's being handed out? What do you look at as, you know, and please offer, you know, what might be just pessimistic speculation. But, you know, like how. The way that this war is being treated in the media, what kind of a tool is that? What kind of a strategy in terms of the use of the media does that make for the law?
Well, I think there's a lot of issues associated with the media. The Pentagon has reporters traveling with them for obvious reasons. Okay, the Pentagon doesn't want reporters there to tell stories that it doesn't want to tell. But on the other hand, I think there's a double-edged sword here for the military. It needs to have them in order to spin the information the way it wants. And, you know, we see when these reporters are riding with the 7th Cavalry and, you know, all of this stuff now, cruising through the desert. You know, there's a certain adrenaline rush associated with the reporting, and the technology is just absolutely unbelievable. I mean, the fact that we can get live direct feeds from a tank traveling at 45 miles an hour across the desert, you know, instantaneously, you know, in our living room, it's profound. And the journalists, for the most part, you know, I think, are covering this war from a very narrow perspective. and they will have a certain, you know, certain affinity towards the soldiers who they're traveling with because they know them and they're protecting them, they're actually being protected by them, in addition to the broader corporate culture of the media. But at the same time, you know, I think many of these journalists are, in fact, well-trained. And if they start seeing things that, depending on, you know, is reluctant to have evolved, I think we'll see to some extent. We're not going to see the whole context, obviously. The best way to determine what you're getting is to review a multiple of sources. You know, there's a handout, I don't know where this came from, this is on the desk.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, but anyway, the website, you know, my website, for example, I have links to literally hundreds of foreign news organizations. Assume for the purposes that information coming from official statements are, in fact, you know, they have a political agenda associated with it. So the U.S. government, the British government, when Al Jazeera, when the Iraqi government, you know, whatever, you know, anybody who's reporting something is trying to give you some story, some spin the way they want to give it to you. Review a wide array of press coverage and try and figure it out. What seems to make the most logical sense? Compare and contrast how reporting is done. If things line up according to a certain way, you get a general sense. But in the end, you know, part of the process of reviewing the material now is it's in such short time period, that we just don't know what's going on. During the first Persian Gulf War, we heard all these stories about the Patriot missiles being so successful, and we later found out they weren't. Our expectation should be that what we're being told now is stuff that we won't know for sure anything about until much later. So whether or not it's the images of dancing in the street or the images of Iraqis spitting on soldiers, we don't know whether that's an isolated event or a broader context. Keep in mind that we should not respond to this on a minute-by-minute basis. It takes more time for the event to unfold. And we should probably step back away from the coverage and try and distance ourselves from it, you know, in part for your own psychological well-being, but also distance yourself from it so that you can get a broader perspective. And I can talk a lot more about the media itself and how technology is fundamentally transforming the way they're reporting. You know, if an anchor is going to a live direct feed, a reporter in the field 15 times a day, that means that the reporter in the field is actually standing by the video phone 15 half-hour sequences over the course of the day. That means they're not doing a whole lot of the traditional reporting, going out and getting the story. It means they're relying on the technology to talk about what they superficially know. Anyway, all of those things come into play here in the report. Assume for the purposes that we're getting information, but try and step back away from it.
Facebook going 1, 2, and 3, and then back here. Okay. And then, did I miss people here? Okay. 1, 2. I'll stop. I've seen that certain people. And we want the people we're meeting afterwards to have their chance too, so maybe we'll finish with that. So.
I agree 100% with Greg that we ought to cultivate an alternative value that appreciates the complexity of the whole, as opposed to dealing with blinkers and issues. John, you talked a little bit about the reason, probably not just the oil statistics. Then we talked a little bit about, you know, maybe it's because we're trying to intimidate other countries in the long run. Then you, Paula, you talked about, you know, the art of asking people questions, maybe, and saying that, you know, depending on how you ask the questions, the polls tend to sort of manipulate people. You, Michael, you wrote a whole book on the results of wars, talking about the oil. So it's not just the oil, it's not just China, it's more complex. I guess it's for all of us. What is it? I know there's just one single answer, but I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that, because after all, that's what we're here for, to try to get a more complex view of the problem.
Well, partly, it's your job to express all of this and create a complex view. We can give you the, you have the complexity
Sure, but I'll ask whether anyone wants to start this.
Okay, having argued for complexity, you now force me to become simplistic. Okay. I think as somebody who studied American studies, both American studies, this is about the importance of using power to project a vision of what the global community should be like, and it should look like us. That's why I use the phrase cultural isolationism, which we're in the middle of a sort of imperialistic expansion, projecting forcibly. When you talk about what isolationism seems contradictory or counterintuitive. But this is a belief. This is a messianic quality. We are, quote, the city on the hill. These values need to be defended. We should not be embarrassed about, I'm now trying to gather that language, please don't attribute it to me. We should not be afraid or embarrassed to use our power to assert the values that we believe are the universal values that everybody should be following. Therefore, do not be afraid to project power. We must project power. We have a moral responsibility to project that power. And that is already the underlying vision that drives, and it has a domestic counterpart.